Democrats are struggling with the prospect of the 2010 congressional elections. They may be more than a year away, but Democrats know the party in power usually loses at least some seats in the midterm elections. And some lawmakers even think back to 1994. That's when Democrats, shortly after the election of Bill Clinton to the White House, lost control of Congress. NPR News analyst Juan Williams joins us now. He's in our studios live. Good morning, Juan.
Good morning, Steve.
How much are lawmakers talking about these elections?
It's in the background of every conversation about every piece of legislation now going through Capitol Hill. It's in conversations at the White House about how to persuade, especially conservative Democrats, to hold the line. And it's in conversations on the Hill among Republicans in terms of taking a hard stand against President Obama on healthcare legislation, focusing on deficit spending and potential tax increases.
You said conservative Democrats. You're saying that there are some conservative Democrats who naturally have to think. We can call them cynical, but they have to think. It's part of their job. Is this vote going to cost me my job in 2010? That's what they have to be thinking, right?
Well, let's just be very plain about it. There are about 50 congressional districts in this country where John McCain won the presidential race in 2008. But those congressional districts also sent Democrats to the House of Representatives. So those are fairly conservative districts. And oftentimes they're located in rural or suburban districts that historically have been Republican districts, but decided in the wave of 2008 to send a Democrat to the House. Those people know that they are on an edge, and Republicans have identified their districts as vulnerable.
And is part of their vulnerability also that these, in many cases, are more conservative Democrats than have been nominated by the party in the past? That was deliberate, it was conscious, but you don't want them to be then tagged, or if you're a Democrat, you don't want them to be tagged as part of a liberal or left-leaning party.
Correct. And this is interesting. I mean, Rahm Emanuel, now the White House Chief of Staff, at one point was running many, in fact, encouraging many conservative Democrats, people who were even formerly Republicans, people who were military veterans, in some case sheriffs, business people, who would you would think would be more aligned with conservative values, to look at the Democratic Party, putting them out there as conservative Democrats because they could win in those districts. And so now you have a situation where they have to be responsive to those districts, and politically, Republicans see opportunity.
Well, let's talk about the actual effect on legislation. We've heard elsewhere in the program today, Juan Williams, reference to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, who himself faces re-election from a relatively conservative state, Nevada, in 2010. And we heard a quote about Harry Reid: he's made of steel. He's not going to think about the election. He's going to think about getting health care through. Is it really going to affect, though, a bill like health care?
It's got to affect a bill like health care. And in fact, when this week, when you heard that Olympia Snowe had decided to become the one Republican to back the Senate finance bill, the large hope in the among the political class on the Democrat side was to say, well, gee, maybe that could be cover for some of the conservative Democrats. They could say, well, there's a Republican who voted for this bill, and therefore you as a conservative Democrat could go back to your constituents and say, here's why I'm taking these steps, and look, there are some moderate Republicans. Remember, Steve, a lot of this is about independent voters, and the question is whether independents can be persuaded to stick with Democrats going into 2010.
Aren't there Democrats who've explicitly said, I can't vote for health care unless there is some Republican support going on?
Absolutely. That's part of the deal. And again, you mentioned Harry Reid, you know, the Senate Majority Leader. He's thinking back to 94, as you referenced, a year in which you saw 54 seats switch hands over to the Republicans, the so-called Republican Revolution. And, you know, he's thinking back to people like Tom Foley, who was then Speaker of the House, who lost his seat in that 94 midterm.
Well, what about the House of Representatives? We've talked mostly about the Senate here. The House is a place where Democrats have a big advantage at the moment. Couldn't they afford to lose a few seats?
Well, they could afford to lose a few seats if you're thinking in terms of controlling the majority. But what they want to do, obviously, Democrats, is to hold on. Now, Democrats have pushed their margins, I think, to extremes because of the support of President Obama. I should say the enthusiasm in the base for President Obama. Of course, President Obama will not be on the ticket in 2010. A lot of those people are going to lose that cover that came with what happened in 08. And a lot of them are looking at issues like immigration, don't ask, don't tell for gays, and others, and thinking, you know, these are potentially strong negatives that, again, they're going to allow Republicans some foothold going into that race.
And at the same time that Democrats look vulnerable, some of their fiercest supporters and biggest fundraisers are kind of disenchanted at the moment, aren't they?
Well, that's the whole key, the base. We're thinking about the base. Who's giving the money and who's going to come out to vote? And in midterms, what we most often see is the opposition party. That's the history here, especially for the Republicans.
Juan, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Steve.
NPR News analyst Juan Williams. We're going to report next on tensions between the school system and the teachers' union in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Schools Chancellor Michelle Rhee wants to make dramatic changes to teacher pay and job security. She's gotten a lot of national attention for trying to turn around a troubled school system, but she's been unable to negotiate a contract with teachers. And then D.C. schools laid off more than 200 teachers this month. Rhee said it was an effort to close a budget gap. The union says she had a different motive. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
The Washington Teachers Union has sued to block the layoffs and taken its fight with Chancellor Rhee to the streets with rallies like this one, where union leaders railed against her. They wanted to know why she hired over 900 teachers this summer, knowing that layoffs might be on the horizon. And they questioned her claims that layoffs were due to a $44 million budget shortfall, despite millions of dollars D.C. has received in stimulus funds to avert teacher layoffs.
Something doesn't add up. This is either tremendous mismanagement or malevolence of the worst kind.
Randy Weingarten is president of the American Federation of Teachers. The AFT has been advising the local union ever since Rhee arrived 2 years ago. Union leaders have resisted Rhee's push for pay for performance and abolishing tenure, which is why the union's contract negotiations with Rhee have gone nowhere. George Parker, president of the Washington Teachers Union, says his dealings with Rhee have gone something like this.
Where are we going, Chancellor Rhee? Doesn't matter. Don't question where we are going. Do as I say, or you need to be out of here. No one knows what's best for the children but the chancellor.
Rhee concedes that this month's layoffs have pushed her already rocky relationship with the teachers' union to a new low.
Which is unfortunate, but at the same time, when you are seeing such a radical departure from how people are used to operating, you're going to get a lot of pushback.
Rhee insists that little else will change and improve if she doesn't do something about the quality of teachers. But by defending seniority and tenure, says Rhee, the union is a hindrance to change.
The union mentality to protect the jobs of its members at all costs is not in the long term a viable strategy for radically transforming the learning outcomes for the kids in this city.
So when forced to lay off teachers, Rhee says her instructions to principals were simple. Keep the most effective teachers, even if they're not the most experienced. But union president George Parker says Rhee's orders were to fire teachers opposed to her policies.
And I've talked to some principals who have said, they told us, this is an opportunity for you to get rid of those loudmouthed teachers, anyone else you want to get rid of in your building.
Rhee denies that anybody in the school system has said that to principals. Many veteran teachers who were laid off, though, say they were targeted. Emma Johnson is one of them. She's the only certified chemistry and biology teacher at Spingarn High School, and she still doesn't know why she was fired.
There was no reason given, and my yearly rating, I've been here since 96. I haven't gotten anything less than exceeding expectations.
Johnson, a tall, thin woman in her late 50s, showed up to our interview in a business suit, holding a plaque from the Capitol Hill Kiwanis Club, one of dozens of awards she says she's received from business groups, churches, and foundations.
I'm very confident I'm getting my job back because I'm a very good teacher.
One, two, three, four, escort me right out the door.
At last week's rally, lots of students and parents showed up to support teachers and their union. But at least one person was there to denounce them.
Our kids in D.C. can't read nor write. For 20 years, this went on. 2 decades, this went on.
As the rally wound down, a distraught woman approached the stage where union officials were speaking. She squirmed out of a security guard's arms and began screaming.
Y'all let your black kids not be able to read or write. You did it, not Marie. Y'all did it.
You can go home now, man.
Annie Mayo says she's 62, a mother and grandmother. Mayo is a reminder that parents in the nation's capital are tired and frustrated. For decades, they've waited for good teachers and good schools, and they're still waiting for someone to be held accountable for providing them. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel. Mark DiVincenzo, when is the best time to defrost your freezer?
When the ice buildup reaches 1/4 inch deep. You'll waste energy if you do it more or less often than that.
And when's the best time to redeem frequent flyer miles?
As soon as an airline announces a new route. There's plenty of seats available at that time.
Now, Mark DiVincenzo has written a book that's full of answers to questions like these, questions that begin, when is the best time? The book is called Buy Ketchup in May and Fly at Noon. So, Mark DiVincenzo, let's start with the wisdom in the title. Why is May the best time to buy ketchup?
Because, Robert, that's the beginning of picnic season. You can find ketchup, mustard, relish, all kind of picnic-related items on sale in May. Their prices are low. They want to get you in the store, buy those items, and then buy other things while you're there.
And why fly at noon?
Because airport rush hour mimics highway rush hour. There are just fewer people, shorter lines, less stress and aggravation.
Now, we should explain that these questions, when is the best time, that you've collected into your book, address all kinds of activities, including learning. And I'd like to ask you, when is the best time of day for students to study something that they need to remember for a long time?
8 p.m. to midnight is the best time. It has to do with the nervous system. It's particularly aroused at about 8 p.m., and long-term memory improves during this arousal period.
And when is the best time of day for students to study something that they need to remember for a short time?
That's in the morning. 9 to 11 is a great time for that. Short-term memory is just more efficient late in the morning.
So you're telling me that this program is on at a time of day when people are less likely to remember anything either for a long time or a short time.
I'm sure that everything said on this program people do remember.
Whenever.
Yes.
Was there one nugget of wisdom like this about the best time to do something that started you off collecting all of these things?
Not one nugget, really. And I can't even take credit for the idea for the book. My wife is one of those people who comes up with 10 great ideas a day. Unfortunately, I don't listen to all of them, but I listened when she said, hey, you should write a book about the best time to do things or buy things or go places.
When is the best time to listen to your wife make suggestions?
Always, you know that.
Okay. In the course of researching this book, which we will add here, is carefully annotated, was there some wisdom about when it's best to do something that really surprised you?
I grew up when if you had a burn on your arm or on your skin, you just would put ice on it right away. But the best time to put ice on a burn is never.
Never, yes.
It turns out that it does more harm than good. It slows the healing process and can even cause frostbite.
Have you actually changed any of your routines or habits based on what you've discovered in researching this book?
Well, I can tell you that I stocked up, got a year's worth of ketchup in May.
I see. So you're way ahead of the game there.
Yeah.
Mark DiVincenzo, author of Buy Ketchup in May and Fly at Noon, a guide to the best time to buy this, do that, and go there. Thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Robert.
Our next item might be called, if you must read this, okay, but please read it in a different way. That's what Chinua Achebe, the great Nigerian novelist, says about Joseph Conrad's classic Heart of Darkness. Achebe, who's now 78, has just published a collection of essays, and we spoke recently at his home in upstate New York. In 1958, Achebe published his first novel, Things Fall Apart, which stood fiction writing about Africa on its head. In it, the world read about the coming of the British to Africa as Africans experienced it. Achebe first excoriated Conrad's novella about Africa back in the 1970s. In Heart of Darkness, the English sailor Marlowe steams up the Congo in search of Kurtz, the European gone native. Chinua Achebe says he grew up identifying with Marlowe.
Conrad was a seductive writer. He could pull his reader into the fray. And if it were not for what he said about me and my people, I would probably be thinking only of that seduction. And as a child growing up, one was the subject of Conrad's seduction. As you grow older, you suddenly realize, as I think I've said somewhere, that you were not on Marlowe's ship.
Yes, I found the essay in which you write. You said, a time came when I reached the appropriate age and realized that these writers had pulled a fast one on me. I was not on Marlowe's boat steaming up the Congo in Heart of Darkness. Rather, I was one of those unattractive beings jumping up and down on the riverbank,
okay,
making horrid faces.
Right. I'm glad you got that so well. That's the point where you understand that there are two humanities. We are not all the same. And then I realize how terribly, terribly wrong it was to portray my people, any people, from that attitude, from that point of view.
The point of, I am the civilized person,
yes,
exploring and encountering the uncivilized, the people who are elemental and
yes,
live the
yes,
primeval existence here.
That's right. And he would give them names that are really unmentionable, describing an African working on the ship as a dog wearing trousers and attempting, obviously without success, to make something of the meter he was supposed to be watching. The language of description of the people in Heart of Darkness is inappropriate.
Of course, when you first made this criticism many years ago, Conrad defenders rose up and said, no, he was really an anti-imperialist. This is the description of the people of empire made of their imperial subjects. But Conrad wasn't sympathetic to them. You don't buy it.
No, I don't buy that at all. It's an issue that, for me, is finished and closed. Those who want to go on enjoying the presentation of some people in this way, they are welcome to go ahead. The book is there. I didn't carry it away. I simply said, read it this way. And that's all I have done.
That's Nigerian novelist Chinua Achebe speaking about Joseph Conrad's novella, Heart of Darkness. Achebe's new collection of essays is called The Education of a British Protected Child.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. For the first time, we have a concrete idea of how many jobs we're getting from the federal stimulus. Up to now, most claims about the spending plan have been based on economic models, estimates at best. Now, federal contractors have reported some specific numbers. The contractors say they created just over 30,000 jobs. They received only a small slice of the $787 billion, but their report has set off a big debate. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The job numbers were posted yesterday at the website recovery.gov, part of the administration's effort to make the stimulus spending transparent. The jobs posted reflect workers hired by private employers with government contracts, jobs like putting a new roof on a federal building or construction work at a military base. There are $16 billion worth of such contracts in the stimulus bill, about 2% of the stimulus spending, according to Jared Bernstein. He's Vice President Biden's chief economist. Bernstein says the preliminary numbers are but a corner of the big picture, but he says it shows the program is working.
We're very much on track to create or save about 1 million jobs so far, 3.5 million jobs before we're done. Now, no one, including the president, the vice president, ever thought or advertised this as fully offsetting the deepest recession since the Great Depression, but it certainly has helped to offset some of the pain.
Bernstein's boss, Vice President Biden, was in St. Louis yesterday, where he sounded a similar note.
I'm here today to tell you, mainly to give you hope, that we are making genuine progress, real progress. We've got a lot further to go, but I believe we've made a great start.
But Republicans continue to criticize the stimulus as ineffective, pointing to the nearly 10% national unemployment rate. House Minority Leader John Boehner issued a statement saying, quote, "No amount of happy talk can paper over this administration's broken promises and faulty projections." Douglas Holtz Aiken, who served as GOP presidential candidate John McCain's economic advisor in last year's campaign, says the report of 30,000 jobs doesn't amount to much.
I don't think this is going to win the political battle. This is a really weak number.
A bigger number is expected at the end of the month, when the government reports on the jobs created by state and local governments and from grants. Mary Buffwack is the CEO of United Neighborhood Health Services in Nashville. Her company has received some $2.5 million in stimulus grants for community clinics it runs.
So far in the 9 months of stimulus, we've spent about $200,000. We've hired 23 new staff people. We've seen 3,600 new patients in that time.
The numbers to be released in 2 weeks will also include those hired as workers on road construction projects and teachers who are able to keep their jobs. That will give a slightly more complete picture of the effect the stimulus is having on the still struggling economy. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Washington.
It takes about half a second to turn something we think into something we say. Scientists have been studying just what happens in our brains during that half second, and there's a lot of activity found in the part of the brain that's the subject of our next report. It's a part of the brain called Broca's area. Now, after more than a century of effort, scientists have found some clues to what happens there. NPR's John Hamilton has the story.
A lot of what we know about how speech works in the brain comes from a French doctor in the 19th century. His name was Pierre-Paul Broca.
He had two patients, and they both had a very strange pattern of mental problems.
Ned Sahin is a researcher at UC San Diego and Harvard University. Sahin has spent a lot of time pondering Dr. Broca and his two famous patients.
They were aware of their situations. They could see and hear. They can even understand what people were asking them, but they couldn't answer back.
Broca suspected brain damage, so after his patients died, he took a look.
The patients both had holes in the brain, and they were in roughly the same area. And so that area became known as Broca's area.
It lies just beneath your left temple. Somehow, this part of the brain helps us speak. But scientists haven't learned much more than that, despite lots of autopsies and studies using high-tech brain scans. What they needed was a way to directly monitor the cells in Broca's area in real time. Sahin says you can do that, but you have to put wires into a person's brain.
And humans don't like wires in their head.
So Broca's area remained a mystery until Sahin and a team of researchers came across three very cooperative patients with epilepsy. All three were going to get surgery to remove some of the brain tissue causing their seizures. To plan that surgery, doctors had put dozens of electrodes in their brains. Sahin says the three patients agreed to play a sort of word game on a computer while they were wired up but still conscious.
So, for instance, they might see the word walk and then the sentence frame, everyday they with a blank, or yesterday they with a blank. And the job was to say the form of the word that was correct for that blank.
Meanwhile, the scientists monitored what was happening in Broca's area and precisely when it happened. Sahin says at 200 milliseconds, that's 0.2 seconds after seeing the words, a spike in brain activity suggested they were figuring out what the words meant.
At 320 milliseconds, we saw evidence of grammatical processing. And then at 450 milliseconds, we saw processing for the sound form of the word, queuing up what exactly to say and getting ready to say it.
The results show that Broca's area is involved in several major processes related to speech. Nina Dronkers works at the VA's Northern California healthcare system and treats patients who have language problems caused by brain damage. She says the new study supports what a lot of researchers already suspected.
More and more, we're thinking of Broca's area as a region that can do many different things. And the nice thing about the study is that it shows that even these different functions can emerge within an extremely short time frame.
Drunkers is also intrigued by the study's finding that brain cells working on grammar, for example, seem to be in almost the same place as cells working on comprehension or speech production.
So they might serve one function at one point in time and another function at another point in time.
Scientists think Broca's area probably isn't limited to speech. It may help us process music as well. The new study appears in the journal Science. John Hamilton, NPR News.